Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just when you thought it might be safe to go back in the stores, along came a Boxing Day blizzard, snarling travel along the eastern seaboard and burying one of the most lucrative sales opportunities for retailers under a big, wet blanket of snow. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by the all-new Chevrolet Volt, available soon in select markets. Details at chevyvolt.com. The all-new Chevrolet Volt. It's more car than electric.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Here's hoping you're feeling the glow of a warm holiday. 2 days after a Christmas that left retailers feeling better than they have in years. Many analysts figure the industry overall rang up its best holiday shopping results since 2007. But just when it all seemed to be going so well, came a storm dumping close to 2 feet of snow on many places, grounding planes, sidetracking trains, and blocking many roads. As the snow and ice melt, retailers will likely offer special deals to get the buying momentum going again. But as Marketplace's Janet Babin reports, it may have been a lost weekend, carried away on a nor'easter wind.
In the Northeast, today was a day for digging and blowing your way out of the snow. Shopping, that was farther down on the to-do list for many East Coast residents. The snow is getting moved out of the way, but piles of it could stick around a while. Retail analyst Richard Jaffe with Stifel Nicolaus says so too will the storm's effect on retail sales.
We were thinking about a sales gain of 3 to 5% in the month of December. We're now thinking that number is going to be 2 to 4%.
In Midtown New York, some local and even national retailers like the Dress Barn were closed. Service on many train and subway lines was suspended for much of the day. New York's three major airports were closed part of the day, too. That gave D.C. native Mia Shrecky and her daughter Kylie another chance to shop Fifth Avenue, even if they did have to wait for some stores to open their doors.
We had to go to Starbucks and wait until they opened at 12 noon. So, but the shopping, it's great. I mean, we have the streets to ourselves almost now. It's picking up, but when we came out, we were walking all over the place and there were hardly any vehicles.
Great for those who did brave sidewalk snowdrifts. Not so great for retailers hoping to swing to a profit on the strength of holiday sales. Analysts say these lost shopping days, especially yesterday, won't be recovered. Again, here's Richard Jaffe with Stifel Nicolaus.
The consumer won't shop twice as much tomorrow because they couldn't shop yesterday. Unfortunately, a Sunday is always going to be a better shopping day than a Wednesday or a Thursday.
So while stores could try special promotions to bring shoppers back later this week, it appears some of those potential profits headed out to sea, along with the snowstorm. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
It wasn't just retailers who got socked in the kisser with a big wet snowball. There have been more than 6,000 flight cancellations blamed on the bad weather, and it might be next year, think about it, before some folks can make it home. Blame that on the tight seating that the airline industry runs on in the name of efficiency these days. That means fewer planes are available to redeploy to snowbound areas, and that's created a rebooking challenge that could strand some travelers through the end of the week. To make matters worse, one traveler stranded at New York's JFK airport tried to grab the single taxi he spotted to take him back to Manhattan, but says the driver wanted $100 for the trip. Ah, the free enterprise system at work. Wind and snow notwithstanding, many of us will trek back to stores to return gifts this week. We return up to 30% of all those Christmas reindeer sweaters, as seen on TV, donut makers and the like. As Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, retailers are finding ways to cut back on returns, starting when a gift is purchased.
Amazon has patented technology that may get you what you really want next holiday season. The company will allow you to set rules for the kind of gifts you'll accept. Carl Howe of the Yankee Group says you'll even be able to identify certain gift givers.
If you know Aunt Sally always gets you an ugly sweater,
you can tell Amazon to convert her gift into a gift certificate And Amazon will even send her a thank you note for that sweater you never got. So a retailer that'll cover for you, that's quite the service. There are plenty of reasons for stores to cut back on returns. The National Retail Federation expects returns to total more than $43 billion this holiday season. Roger Kay of Endpoint Technologies says the problem's particularly bad with electronics.
When the goods come back, they could never sell that again as new product. So right away, they take a hit.
Then there's the added shipping cost and labor to restock items. Retailers are also trying to cut costs with programs like SmartPost, which bundles individual packages into larger shipments. Other retailers scan for fraud by tracking customers who may return items too frequently. Madison Riley follows retail at Kurt Salmon.
I think Amazon is setting the tone for retail in general. Certainly they're a guidepost for where retail will move in the future.
But will customers actually start vetting gifts from sweet Aunt Sally? Carl Howe says maybe.
You do have to still face the problem of Aunt Sally wondering why you're not wearing this sweater.
And maybe Aunt Sally won't be so happy if she finds out Amazon didn't send you what she paid for. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Okay, so maybe that takes care of the Jelly of the Month Club, but how would it say poor Ralphie from that pink bunny suit his aunt made him in A Christmas Story? Winter wasn't the only thing that chilled Wall Street today. There was a cold wind from China. Details when we do the numbers. The founder of the anti-secrecy website WikiLeaks says he'd prefer to keep the details of his life to himself. But over the weekend, Julian Assange told London Sunday Times that his mounting legal costs have required him to sign an $800,000 book deal for his memoirs. He, better than anyone, might know that there's not much that stays secret in this age of the Internet. We heard a lot this year about how much companies know about us. Our own Stacey Vanek Smith got her data mined this year, and she joins us to talk privacy. Hey, Stacey.
Hi, Bob.
So, data mining is something companies have been doing for years. Why have we heard so much about it this year?
Well, Facebook. That site has changed the data mining game entirely. A few years ago, the best information a company could get on a consumer probably came from their internet searches, what they were Googling. But with Facebook, companies can find out a lot more. And coupled with our search data, it's pretty powerful. Here's what data miner Robert Grossman was able to find out about me using my Facebook page coupled with my Google search history.
I know your hometown, which is Boise, Idaho. I know where you work. You worked pretty hard doing queries for work. But then it looked like in the evening you would watch TV shows like Glee, look at travel locations. I could see that you're interested in doing a trip to Berkeley, San Francisco.
Now, that would creep me out. That's a lot of information.
It did creep me out, and it is a lot of information. But if you think about it, in a certain way, your Facebook page is like a consumer profile that you have built about yourself. So advertisers can look at it and see who your friends are, where you like to go, what music and books you like, what you're planning to do this weekend.
What do they do with the information?
Well, that's interesting. All of this sounds very 1984. But honestly, advertisers are mostly using this information to show us ads for things that we're pretty likely to want or need. So if you like Arby's on your Facebook page, you'd get a coupon for a roast beef sandwich and you'd actually want to use it.
Okay. So it's not only advertisers, though, that might get a hold of this data. Are there worries that, let's say, insurance companies, others might get this?
That's very true. And the worry is that insurance companies and like creditors might get this information. So if you have a lot of bankrupt people in your social network, your access to credit might be affected. Or if your friends are all smokers, your health insurance premium might go up. And we're actually starting to see that happen a little bit.
Well, what can people do about this going forward? Haven't there been attempts by lawmakers, computer and software makers, to let people block their information?
Yes, there have. Honestly, though, it's going to be really, really hard to do that, especially since creating that data is something we do in our free time on things like Facebook. I put that question actually to Matt Britton. He's the CEO of social marketing firm Mr. Youth, and he said what we really need to focus on, the real solution, is to take ownership of our data.
Building your personal brand is something that is going to be so incredibly important in this new economy. You know, consumers need to craft the right brand using everything from LinkedIn to Facebook to Twitter. Everything they're putting out there can precipitate a lot of what will happen in your life in terms of, you know, how you're perceived by everyone, your friends, your colleagues, you know, prospective mates and prospective employers.
Wait a minute. So I've got to be a brand now with brand images and all that?
It's brand Bob Moon.
Okay.
In a way, yes. Our online profiles are something that we have to manage, and they can really take on a life of their own. And so, Bob, I know what a big South Park fan you are, right?
No. Okay.
Anyway, well, you will be now. There's an episode of South Park about Facebook, and Stan actually has a showdown with his Facebook page.
I'm your profile, and as you can see, I'm much more powerful than you.
Damn it, I should have deleted you a long time ago.
The fact of the matter is, I'm up and running now with almost a million friends. I don't need you anymore. Who is more powerful, the user or the profile? Let's end this once and for all.
Oh, so don't leave us hanging here. Who wins?
Well, you know, they can't kill off a main character. Uh-huh. I guess, unless it's Kenny.
Yeah, but aren't they killing off privacy here?
Well, yes, I guess so. You could sort of look at 2010 as the year that privacy died. Actually, my favorite thing about this topic, the topic of privacy, came from Andreas Weigand. He's a data mining expert at Stanford. Here's what he said.
Maybe privacy was just a blip in history. It started when people moved to cities where they had places to hide. And it ended with the internet, when basically there was no place to hide left.
Weigand says, as a culture, we've basically traded privacy for social connectivity. And he says the younger generation doesn't even really expect or value privacy at all.
Well, I'm sure this isn't the last we've heard of this, Stacey, because as they say, you can run, but
you can't hide.
Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
We've got more of 2010's top business stories in our Year in Review series, as well as our most popular slideshows, videos, and other features. It's all at marketplace.org. It's been a tough year for the Eurozone, the 16 European nations that share the euro as a common currency. A deep debt crisis meant big bailouts, first for Greece, then for Ireland. Now many fear Portugal or Spain could be next. Despite all this, Estonia has decided to join the currency zone in a few days. As of January 1st, it's dropping its old money, the krone. Christopher Worth traveled to the capital of the small Baltic nation to find out how Estonians are reacting to the change.
In Tallinn's snow-covered central square, a dance instructor in a Santa suit put shivering members of the public through their paces in a traditional dance. It takes more than freezing temperatures to scare away this crowd, and it takes more than a European debt crisis to keep some Estonians from wanting to see their country adopt the euro.
I think the Eurozone will survive the crisis. I'm not worried by the news of panic.
But for others, joining the Euro now seems risky.
The Euro will bring difficulties. Nothing good can come of it.
Estonians are almost evenly split on whether dumping their present currency in favor of the Euro will be a good thing or bring the kind of economic turmoil they've seen in other parts of Europe. Martin Poder at Estonia's Ministry of Finance is hard at work trying to convince people of the benefits.
The euro is a logical choice for Estonia.
Logical, he says, because the country has been pegging its currency to the euro for nearly a decade. It's already made the painful adjustments needed for euro membership, slashing public spending even as its economy plunged around 14% last year. Now, Poder says, it's time to reap some of the rewards.
By joining the euro area, you will have more investment, and then with more investment, you have more jobs.
Unemployment in Estonia is over 10%, so the government hopes the euro will bring more high-tech jobs like the ones at this Elcotech factory that makes satellite phones.
So here we have a final assembly station where the board comes from the assembly line.
Arnold Kolk is a business development manager with Elcotech. The company is from Finland, but since opening operations here, it's become one of Estonia's largest exporters.
Being part of Eurozone, I think it's a good sign for business. It does increase the confidence in a country.
And it increases the responsibilities that will fall upon Estonia. The country may be small with just 1.3 million people, but it will now take a seat at the European Central Bank. It will also be expected to contribute to a fund to bail out Eurozone nations that get into economic trouble. Ivar Reg of Tallinn University doesn't think it's a good time for Estonia to join.
Estonia will be the poorest country in the Eurozone, and we are not ready to pay the debt of countries with weak financial discipline.
And given that the debt crisis in Europe isn't over, Reg is urging the country's central bank to hold on to those old Estonian krones just in case. In Tallinn, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If we get a soil-borne disease, we could lose our whole field.
Strawberries, they're delicious. Could they be toxic as well? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 18 points today, or 0.1%, to end at 11,555. The Nasdaq gained 1 point, closing essentially flat at 2667. The S&P 500 picked up less than a point, also closing virtually flat at 1257. Energy and material stocks flagged a bit in the face of a surprise rate hike by China's central bank. China's trying to rein in inflation. Alcoa kicked the can down 0.7%. Halliburton drilled out more than 1%. The average price of retail gas here in the U.S. of A. topped $3 a gallon for the first time since October 2008. But that didn't do much for oil companies like Exxon and Chevron. Chevron drained off 0.6%. Exxon, 0.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering Save the Game, a financial literacy app for children designed for iPod Touch and iPhone, available on the App Store. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. What did you think about the economy this month? The Conference Board releases its Consumer Confidence Index for December. On December 28, 1846, the Hawkeye State was admitted to the Union. Iowa became the 29th star on the flag. And he's known for his superheroes, creating them, that is. Comic book writer and publisher Stan Lee turns 88. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. The financial crisis, the global recession, might make you wonder just what have they been teaching at business schools lately? The people who put together MBA programs have been doing some learning of their own. Yale, Stanford, UC Berkeley, and Johns Hopkins have all revamped their focus in the past few years. The Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania is the latest to join the list. Joining us is Professor Richard Schell. He's chairman of Wharton's MBA Review Committee and a professor of legal studies, business ethics, and management. Thanks for being with us.
Bob, thank you very much.
Professor Schell, this is the first time in 17 years that Wharton has revamped its curricula. I'm guessing that it's no coincidence that there's a real lack of public faith out there in the MBA grads who are behind the big economic mess that we're in. Are these changes a response to that?
Well, Bob, I wouldn't say that. We actually started the review process back in 2007, and then that was followed by a faculty survey. And so by the time my committee was appointed in 2009, we'd been at it for a couple of years. So I would say the financial crisis informed what we were doing, but it wasn't the cause of what we did.
Well, that having been said, let me read you a quick quote from the dean of the business school at Johns Hopkins. He said, the MBA became a degree in methodology. We produced masters of financial engineering, people who didn't have heart and soul. Do you see any truth in that?
Oh, boy. I really don't. Maybe it's because I teach law and ethics myself that I've always felt that the kinds of content that we deliver in our MBA program, at least, is sort of balanced between the human skills of business as well as the analytic skills. In our new curriculum, one of the things we did that I think does respond to that perception is we've doubled the amount of statistics and basic economics that we're delivering to the students with the thought that maybe some of what was missing was a real calibration of what risk really is, and we need to make sure that the people making the decisions up in the top floor know what the people down on the bottom floor are doing when they invent some of these instruments that got us in trouble.
One of the areas that I noticed that you're going to put a renewed focus on is globalization. Why now?
What's happened that we noticed in our research is that the global aspects of business have become much more the background of all business. And so at this point, we're really looking to see how we can move some of our students and our classes overseas to actually be delivered a little bit more on the ground in some of these locations where business is done rather than just study it in a classroom.
Another what I would call real world change that I saw was this idea of tuition-free continuing education. Can you explain that?
We feel very strongly about that. Lawyers have continuing education. That's a requirement of maintaining their license to practice law. Physicians have continuing education. It really looked like a huge opportunity for us to lay the groundwork for a new model. And instead of thinking of an MBA as something that you came, did for 2 years, and then the only other touch was reunions, we see this as a huge opportunity for our graduates to continue to refresh their knowledge and for them to continue to refresh us.
Yeah, it's a recognition that in this day and age, people are bouncing between jobs all the time.
All the time. The average time an MBA graduate is in their first job is 18 months. Hmm. And most of them will go through at least 4 to 6 careers after they graduate. And all of those transitions are going to require them to know something that they didn't know when they left us. So business education begins with your MBA, but it doesn't end with graduation.
Professor Richard Schell, he headed up the MBA Review Committee and teaches law, business ethics, and management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Schell, good to talk to you.
Thank you, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Regulators here in California just approved the use of a controversial pesticide. And if you like strawberries or anything with strawberries, here's why you might care. California grows 90% of the country's strawberries, and the state's approval of this pest killer is aimed at supporting its $1 billion-a-year strawberry industry. No one disagrees that methyl iodide is toxic. The debate is whether or not it can be used safely. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
It's a misty gray day in Oxnard, California. I'm standing on the edge of 35 acres of strawberry plants. Farmer Glenn Hasagawa looks out at his field, green splashed with white flowers and a few red berries, and seems pleased.
They're little power plants. They're definitely workhorses.
But Hasagawa's workhorses are susceptible to disease, fungus, mold, and pests. So Hasagawa uses pesticides and fertilizers to keep them producing.
You know, if you have some type of pest outbreak in your house, the first thing you do is you pull out some ant spray or something like that. And that's kind of what we have to do, too, but on a much larger scale.
Right now, one of the tools Hasagawa uses is a fumigant called methyl bromide. But methyl bromide damages the ozone layer, and international officials got together and agreed to stop using it. So farmers are scrambling to find substitutes, and lots of them are turning to methyl iodide.
I think this is an extremely dangerous chemical.
John Freunds is a professor at UCLA. He headed a group of scientists the state asked to evaluate the chemical. Freunds and his colleagues say it's too dangerous to be used safely. It poses risk to people applying it and those who live nearby.
There were a number of case studies in which humans had been exposed to methyl iodide. And the effects of the methyl iodide were absolutely devastating.
Freund says case studies showed neurological damage. In laboratory animals, there's also evidence of fetal death and cancer. So Freund and his colleagues advised the state against approving methyl iodide. But California regulators went ahead and okayed it.
This particular material, methyl iodide, has been the most comprehensively reviewed material in our history.
Marianne Warmerdam heads the California Department of Pesticide Regulation.
We are confident that with the health protective measures that we have put in place, that it can be used safely in California.
The state allows 100 pounds of the chemical per acre, a number that makes California's laws among the strictest. The feds are okay with nearly double that.
What we look for is if certain materials, chemistries, are required for production, can we have a reasonable degree of certainty that they can be used safely?
And really, that's what we ask regulators to do every day, to judge public health risk in the context of social, economic, and environmental pressures. Back out at the strawberry farm, Glenn Hasegawa trusts the state to get it right.
Since it is approved for use, I would be confident that we could use it safely.
Hasegawa isn't in a rush to use the new chemical. He wants to see how other farmers are faring with it first, but he says he's open to it. He grows some raspberries organically, but says organic strawberries just aren't doable, at least not for what the market's willing to pay.
If we get a soil-borne disease, we could lose our whole field. So we couldn't charge enough to make it feasible for us. It would just be, it wouldn't pencil at all.
And strawberries that cost an extra 50% might not pencil for most of the rest of us. We like our food cheap. So Hasegawa, like most other strawberry farmers, uses the tools that are available. And the state and federal government say methyl iodide can be one of those tools, even if many scientists and pesticide activists disagree. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, American International Group is taking another big step toward borrowing its way off the government dole. The insurance giant revealed in a federal regulatory filing today that it's arranged for $4.3 billion in credit from 36 different lenders. The company's CEO calls it another important vote of confidence by the market in AIG. The Obama administration calls it a milestone in the government's efforts to exit its investment while protecting taxpayers. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 18 points, or 0.1%. The Nasdaq gained 1 point, closing essentially flat. The S&P 500 picked up less than a point, also closing virtually flat. Our producers include Abishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program...
One of the easiest ways to differentiate an economist from almost anyone else in society is to test them with repugnant ideas.
Uh-huh. The latest in our Freakonomics series. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.